Welcome to SidePod Chat. Everyone wants to cuddle. We are happy to be joined today by the fabulous Stuart Codling, who's worked in F1 for years and years and years. You might have heard him featured on Side Podcast before when he set us the champagne challenge and introduced us to the concept of tremaining. Today, we're hoping he doesn't have a challenge for us as we've got loads to talk to him about. A new book, a new blog, a new website, a new F1 season.
Hello, Stuart.
Hello.
You're a person, actually, I'm not sure that introduction does you justice. You've done even more than that. You are, additionally, you used to be deputy editor of F1 Racing.
Indeed.
You were sub-editor of Autosport for, was that in 2006?
That was indeed. God, you found out everything.
I know. We've done our research. You also, if I recall, you worked in the past on the Toyota magazine, which was called One Aim?
One Aim hyphen the Toyota magazine.
Okay, that's the official, that's the wordy title. And if I recall, at some point at the beginning of this year, you were involved in the Red Bulletin as well. Are you still doing that?
Well, yes and no. I do, obviously, lots of freelancing here and there. And I actually did a full month on the Red Bulletin in January because the editor was on paternity leave. And I'll be back there for a couple of weeks in August, I think. And in the issue that's coming out next, so we're at the beginning of April, I think, depending on when, of course, you pop this up on the interweb, the edition of the Red Bulletin with a story I wrote about the Red Bull pit crew being put through some absurd physical challenges to try and get them to change wheels quicker should be in it.
Goodness me. Okay, we will definitely look out for that. Hopefully the show will be out in the next couple of days. Do you know when that's due for release?
I think it falls out of copies of The Independent on the first Tuesday of every month.
And then it appears on the interwebs very shortly after that?
Oh, very quickly after that. And it goes, it's all over the world now. It's quite an amazing enterprise. They have editions in Ireland and, of course, in German, but South Africa and New Zealand as well.
Goodness me. So your writing is appearing everywhere. And not only that, you've still managed to fit in time to write, certainly release one book, and also you're working on another one at the moment, aren't you?
I am indeed. I'm hugely behind on it. And I was actually just today attempting to do a picture selection for the sample chapter of the second book. And it's going to be illustrated with lots of rare and hopefully not massively seen pictures from the Clementaski collection. And the guy who runs the Clementaski collection sent me this massive collection of zip files a few months ago. And I've just been desperately trying to look through it and choose pictures which kind of do the subject justice. And the major difficulty I'm facing at the moment is that in zipping them, they've lost all their information. So all I know is what year they are through the file names. But some of them, it's a little bit tricky, should we say. Obviously, the chapter header is clearly spar because it's a load of cars looking down towards Eau Rouge. Other things, you know, something might be Aintree, there's just cars on their own that you think, okay, that's a van wall, but it's got a number 7 on the side. Did Moss ever have a number 7? Who is it? Is it a championship Grand Prix? Quite tricky stuff. But hopefully, round about this time next year, it'll be out.
In your current book, photographs are featured very heavily. Is that going to be the case of the new one as well?
I think so. You know, I once worked with this photographer who said, well, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words. So I said, well, take a couple more then, and then I won't have to write anything. seriously, though, they're the coffee table style things. And most people like to look at pictures in books anyway. And most of the reviews, I mean, Auto Express are very much on my hate list at the moment for saying it's more of a picture to look at than to, more of a book to look at than to read. And then he gave it 3 stars. Miserable sods that they didn't even read it.
That's very harsh. I haven't read that. How have the reviews of this been, apart from that one, how have you found the reviews so far?
People who've actually read it seem to have liked it.
It makes a difference. We should say the new book is called Art of the Formula One Race Car, and it's available. Ours arrived last week, came from Amazon. Is it in the shops yet?
I think so. The guy, the UK sales guy, emailed to say that I think Waterstones and maybe, I didn't even realise there were any other book chains than Waterstones, but apparently there is another book chain somewhere, and they've made it core stock, so it may actually turn up in bookshops. Hey, it may even be in foils. You never know. If you can find your way to the motor racing section in foils.
And it's a big book. I've got it in my hand now. This is the ultimate coffee table book. I'm kind of looking at it and longing for a bigger house and a better coffee table on which to place this, because it's huge and it's lovely.
We're going to upgrade our coffee table as well, I think, yeah, from our £20 IKEA one to something. I don't know about glass-topped, but certainly something a bit bigger, because, yeah, it's quite a luxurious book. And I was amazed when I first picked it up. I got a copy in the post about a month and a half ago. And when you actually pick it up for the first time, it is quite amazing. They did send me a load of their other books to sort of show me what it would be like, you know, the size and the paper quality. But it is very weird when you open up a padded envelope and find a very nice, very glossy and thickly papered book with your own name on the front.
I was mostly surprised, actually, because it costs, is it £30 in the UK and $45 in America? And for that kind of money, I'm used to getting a small paperback. But this is really good value for money, isn't it? I mean, Christine will tell you, we've been looking at the photographs today. It's a very large format photographs when you open the book up full size, and you get it's amazing value for money, really.
He is a really good photographer. When the project sort of first came my way, which was about 18 months ago now, which is a story in itself, they said that James Mann would be doing the pictures, and I sort of vaguely remembered his name and his pictures because he did work for F1 Racing doing studio shots about 10 years ago, and we did feature a few of his pictures. So I was aware of his work, and what I didn't realise was how quickly and efficiently he does it. He can shoot two cars a day, which, I don't know, it depends on your barometer. Some people might think that's, you know, that's very poor work rate. Surely you must have photographed it all in a day. But, you know, having been on photo shoots with photographers who adore stroking their beards and moving a light 2 inches to the left and then taking some Polaroids and all that sort of thing, it's just amazing to watch James work. He really knows how to light a car and get the best out of it, even in the weirdest of places, because the McLaren, the Lewis Hamilton McLaren, we actually photographed at the technology centre because they wouldn't allow us out of their sight. And they led us into this enormous circular room, which was totally empty. And it was like the war room in Doctor Strangelove. And it was round. And James just sort of, his eyes rotated in his skull as he thought, how am I going to light this fantastically curvaceous car in this room? And yet he managed to do it. It looks really good.
And we should probably say, how would you describe the concept of this book? Because it's called The Art of the Formula One Car, and your role within it appears to be to give background to the cars that are featured. There are 18 Grand Prix cars throughout Formula One's history, spanning almost 60 years of Formula One racing. From there's an Alfa Romeo from the 1950s all the way up to the Lewis Hamilton car you just mentioned, the MP423, which was a 2008 car. And throughout the book, your role is to give background into what makes the car significant, I guess, significant moments, reasons for choosing it. And then James has photographed it in a way that maybe it's never been seen before, which is out of the racing environment and inside a studio.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And what we, as we sort of talked about it and various lists got bounced around on the email about what cars we should do and what areas we should focus on, we kind of decided that it would make a stronger final product if it wasn't just a random selection of cars that I wrote a bit of background about, but if sort of taken together, it presents a sort of rough summary, if you like, of the story arc, as you know, American scriptwriters like to call it, of the sport. So you start off with the exact car that Farina drove to victory in the first World Championship Grand Prix, which is, what, 60 years ago in this May. And it goes all the way to, I don't know whether it was one of the race cars or whether it was a show car, but it's certainly in the complete aero spec of Lewis's 2008 championship winner. And we thought that the cars we had in between should be sort of significant and interesting. And, of course, when you have a certain number of pages to do, we kind of knew that there were actually going to be 19 cars in the book, but one of them fell out at the last minute because, well, it was in pieces and being restored. So we didn't actually, we just couldn't photograph it in time. So there is a missing chapter, which I may put on the blog at some point, although it won't have been edited and translated into American. So there will be more U's and there will be S's instead of Z's, which I can promise the English readership. But no, it was a really interesting book to work on. And we did have to make some tough decisions. So a lot of people have read it and said, why no Lotus 25? And there's a long and a short answer to that. The short answer is that James has already photographed the Lotus 25 years ago and wanted to photograph something else. And the even shorter answer is that we would have had three Lotuses in a row. So we sort of thought, well, what's fairly representative of that era? And we nearly ended up at the Porsche, the ex-Gurney 1962 Porsche, just as something that's a little bit off the wall. And then we thought, no, we should probably get a sort of a V8 monocoque. So we thought, do we do Cooper? James thought certainly the 59 Cooper is actually not a very impressive car to look at. It's a bit boring. It's very black and very plain. And so we thought, all right, well, let's do the BRM because it's a very interesting story. They were an absolute mess of a team. They were completely incompetent. And the classic British build it in a shed ethos of lots of eccentric ideas that didn't quite work together with any engineering rigor at all. So it's very, very interesting.
If there are lots of cars that you wanted to do but couldn't fit them in, is there the possibility of a second volume?
Well, depending on the sales figures for this one, they may come back wanting a second volume. It'd be tricky to sort of kind of present the same story again, but there were just lots and lots of cars. There were cars that we wanted to have, but we couldn't get. So I sent a fax to Mr. Eccleston asking if I could have, or if we could borrow the 1983 Brabham, the arrow-shaped one, which would have been really, really interesting and also fascinating story. And it got a bit of dead air in response to that. And very frustrated a few months ago to find one of those cars on the cover of Motorsport. So I emailed Damien, the editor, to say, where did you dig that up from? and he said, we just asked BMW. They had one in their museum. Well, why didn't we think of that? Because Mercedes actually paid to fly James over to photograph the streamlined Mercedes in their museum at Stuttgart. And there were a couple of other cars. The other one, the one that actually fell out, was the Brabham BT44, which is the sort of early 70s car, one of the early Gordon Murray Brabhams. And the car we were going to photograph is currently being raced by Count Manfredo Rossi in historic Formula One. It's actually a BT42 with a BT44 body kit and the Carlos Reutemann era Martini sponsorship on it. And the trouble was that car was actually in bits being restored all the way through the production cycle of the book. So even though I'd written the chapter for it, in the end, Motorbooks just said, look, we've got to start designing this book now. So we'd better just sort of put it down to experience and have the 18 cars in. And then about 2 weekends later, I switched Motors TV on one Sunday and saw the car being raced at Silverstone by Rossi. And I phoned James up and said, turn Motors TV on. They're racing our car.
We haven't mentioned, actually, you just mentioned the name Gordon Murray. We should point out that there's three of you involved in this book. You're doing the history and the important points of the car. James is obviously taking the photographs. And then what's Gordon's role in this book?
Gordon is our expert commentator. And this is something Motorbooks are very specific they wanted, not just as a kind of a marketing point for the book, but so it is actually has a proper expert view and not some journalist blowing smoke up each car's exhaust pipe. And we sort of thought, who could do it? Would a modern technical director do it? And there were a few names bandied around. And my editor at Motorbooks, a guy called Jeff Zelke, said, do you think we could get Gordon Murray? And I sort of said, well, yeah, I've interviewed him before. He's quite difficult to get hold of. But, you know, if you make an appointment well enough in advance, then, you know, it can be done. And we made an appointment about a month and a half in advance. And I printed out all the photographs of, well, not all the photographs, because that would be several hundred, but I printed out a few pictures of each car we'd done. And I just went down to his office, which isn't actually very far from where I live, with a bottle of nice wine to make it worth his time. And we spent a couple of hours just going through the pictures and talking about each car. And I recorded it and then turned it into sort of a running commentary. And it's actually quite interesting when you look at, if you were to just go through the book looking at his comments, you start off with the cars in the early 50s, which were the ones he grew up looking at pictures of in magazines like Autosport and whatnot. These are the cars that really inspired him to become a Formula One designer. And then you make it through to the cars that were his contemporaries when he was designing. So he has an interesting perspective on the Lotus 72 that, you know, didn't think much of the suspension or that sort of thing. And then we start getting to where he was starting to get bored with Formula One because he thought the rules were too restrictive and it was all getting a bit too aerodynamic. And we end up at the MP423 where he says, you know, this epitomizes everything that I hate about Formula One.
Which is odd because I think it's the one that we like the most.
Yeah, it's a great looking car, and it's the pinnacle of the aero optimized era, isn't it? When, you know, the cars were designed in an ever more restrictive box. But, you know, the surfacing, it's got curves on top of curves and bumps and bulges and swoops. It's just amazing. But it sort of shows you that cars aren't designed by one person anymore. They're designed by teams of people who will be, you know, five people working on an end plate. So it must be very, very difficult to pull all those people together, even with McLaren's optimized matrix management system or whatever they call it.
Do you have a favorite? Is that something we can ask you? Can you answer that question? Of a photograph that you look through this book and say, that is a combination of a fantastic photograph, a fantastic car. It stands for something important, and I'm really glad that this made it into this book.
It's so hard to come up with a favourite car. My personal favourite, I think, is the Alpha 158. And I made a point of going up to the studio where James was photographing it, which is actually also coincidentally not that far from here. And quite an interesting, the studio itself has an interesting story in that it's in the grounds of a pub, which was where the Vintage Sports Car Club was founded. And it is really, it's an old shed or an old stable. So I wasn't actually quite sure how they managed to fit the car in there, because I couldn't see a door big enough to get this thing through. It was as if they actually dismantled it and put it back together in the studio. And there it was. And it was just amazing. It's newly restored. There are only two in the world, and the other one is in a museum in Italy. And it was the exact car that Farina won the 1950 British Grand Prix in. It was just amazing because it's so small and quite scary. But the owner let me sit in it for the picture on the sleeve. I took my shoes off because I didn't want to get any dirty marks on this lovely velour upholstery seat, which was probably a restored version of the one for an assassin, because it was in far too good nick to be 60 years old. And you sit there and you look down this long bonnet. You have this tiny little wood-rimmed steering wheel. The exhaust pipe is really close to your elbow, so how he never burned himself alive, I don't know. And you're sitting on top of the prop shaft. It goes right under your legs. So you're sitting really high. It's everything that a modern Formula One car isn't.
One thing I love looking at the pictures now, is somehow James has got this translucent look to the engine cover. Presumably you've taken two photographs and merged them to get that effect, have you?
He did indeed. It's all that sort of, I would say Photoshop, but Adobe don't like people using Photoshop as a generic verb, do they? Not that they can stop us. We Photoshopped it, yeah. it's an amazing effect. I quite like it, actually, because we see lots of pictures of that absurd great bassoon of a supercharger, and you sort of think you must have been able to hear it going as it sort of sucked in all the air. It's amazing. I'm surprised they didn't blow up more often. I mean, basically, you are sitting above and behind a bomb when you're in that car, really, because the fuel tank, you know, probably was made of paper because the Italians didn't really have good materials to make cars out of then. So it was a death trap. And also something that, this is going to sound terribly name-droppy, but as Stirling Moss said to me that before I cursed him and he ended up falling down his lift chair, these cars those days were largely made out of road car bits. You know, when he drove for ERA, the hubs and the castings and various bits, they were from a Morris Oxford or something. There were very few bespoke racing car bits, and the Alphas had been, if you believe the hype, had been sitting in a cheese factory or in a cave surrounded by cheese all the way through World War II. And they finally sort of wiped the cheese off and just went racing again. So they must have been, at the very least, you know, metal fatigue taking its toll on the various bits.
We've been very lucky, and while you've been writing the book, you've been leaving us lots of cryptic comments on Side Podcast. The book covers 60 years of F1 history, and it feels like it almost took that long to come out. How have you found your first experience of book publishing?
Well, I thought magazine publishing was slow, but when you think the offer to write the book actually pinged into my inbox on the day I learned that I was going to, well, at least the job I was occupying at the time was no longer going to exist in a few weeks. So that's what, November 2008. I actually delivered the manuscript in May 2009. And it then went into the copy editing procedure, and they do copy edit very, very carefully. I got the manuscript back about a month and a half later with lots and lots of little red lines here and there. Jeff's a very polite editor. You know, he's obviously dealt with lots and lots of prissy authors who don't like people editing their text before. So there were lots of little polite suggestions that something was a bit waffly and should go, or particularly in the intro, that various things should go entirely and other bits should be not where they were and they should be elsewhere. So we sort of agreed with all that, went through the whole thing, and then it went into design. And then I sort of almost forgot about it because I was working on the next book, I was starting to work on the next book. And then all of a sudden it appeared almost a year later, on the doorstep, because it was too big to fit through the letterbox. It's just such an amazing thing that it takes so long. I don't know. It printed in China, I think. I don't know. Maybe they strapped the proofs to the top of a snail and sent it to China. Jeff went quiet for a few weeks. Maybe they actually made him paddle to China to deliver the discs with the book on. I don't know.
It hasn't put you off the publishing industry, though, because you're diligently, apparently, working on your next piece.
Yeah, diligently is the word I use when I tell people. But obviously, the problem when you're writing a book is that people ring you up and ask you to do things, and because you're a freelancer, you always say yes. So it kind of gets put to one side while you do that thing, and then someone else rings you up and asks you to do something, and then all of a sudden you realise several weeks have gone by and you haven't really got much work done, so you have a bit of a panic and start nudging it on. It's the complete opposite of how you work with the internet, where, let's say, you get to the end of a race and, you know, it's fastest fingers first, isn't it? You have to get your results up straight away, you have to get the post-race reaction. If you went to a Grand Prix and sat in the press room and watched the Autosport people set to work at the end of the race, you know, it's this fantastically syncopated thing where the people who are on site rush off and get quotes, the people who are working on remote work on various bits, and that's why when you go to the site half an hour after the race, it's got everything that's ever happened ever on it, because it's loads and loads of people all descending on it and shoveling it onto the internet, because the monster has to be fed. Whereas book publishing, it's a solo thing. It's you and your editor sort of pushing it along a little bit at a time.
How does it feel to be a published author, though? Has it changed you in any way?
Well, obviously I have to do autographs now, darling. Do you know that autographs are much more difficult than you think, because you point the pen above the page once you've actually got to the right bit, And then with this book, you have that whole thing, do I put it above or below the title? What if they want to do a dedication? And then, of course, you realise the ink's run out. You have to get another pen, and it's too fat. Then you're rushing around with all these pens. And then, of course, you're well aware that once you've actually touched the pen on the page, there's no stopping now. So if you... I don't know, maybe I'm the only person in the world who cocks up my signature every now and then. You're just sort of all of a sudden aware that if you get it wrong, you've ruined their book. Then again, you know, what are they to know? I mean, unless you give them your credit card, they look on the back of it. They may think every signature's like that. And then, of course, you get those pens that take ages to dry. So you're just sitting there going, trying not to get spittle on the page as you try and dry your signature off.
Just before we should also you just mentioned Autosport at the Paddock. We should talk about your experience with that very shortly. But before we move on, one other thing I wanted to mention is in this book you managed to convince the Donington Collection to release a couple of their cars for photography. How did you manage to do that? Because obviously the Donington Collection Donington itself has been dragged through the blender in the past year or so. How are things at Donington, and how have you managed to convince them to release the cars for you?
Well, it was a very, very cold day, round about the last February. So right in the middle of that really nasty cold snap, I drove up to Donington and met James there. And we basically we'd arranged to have a meeting with Kevin Wheatcroft, who's Tom Wheatcroft's son, who looks after the collection. Tom himself wasn't there because we didn't even know at the time that he was ill, but... That was how it turned out. And, you know, clearly Kevin takes great responsibility for these cars in the collection. Not all of them belong to Donington. Some of them are on loan. They have a large collection of Williamses that belong to Williams. So, of course, they're not keen to let, any pair of shysters turn up and whistle them out under them. So they wanted to see our bona fides, and they wanted to know a bit more about what the book was about. So we took some samples of other motor books, and we just walked around and sort of pointed out the cars we wanted. And I know that you both absolutely loathe and detest the Autosport show and everything it stands for, but one of the things that I do when I'm hosting on the F1 racing stand at the Autosport show is to stand and waffle about each car for a bit down into the microphone. And I basically did that to poor Kevin Wheatcroft, who looked like a rabbit in the headlights as I waffled on about each car in turn and told stories about it and that sort of thing. And by the end of the morning, he was sort of white and shaking and ready to sign on any dotted line to give us cars so that we would leave and let him sit down and have a cup of tea. And that's how it was. We nabbed the cars. James took them off to a nearby studio, and he photographed two a day. We actually got quite a few cars from the Donington collection. The others, I think we borrowed the 72 from Classic Team Lotus in the end. The Merc, as I said, we got from Mercedes themselves. The Maserati 250F was for sale and probably now has a new owner, but it actually had quite an interesting history because it hadn't actually been bought to race to begin with. It had actually been bought by the Vandervelde family to copy for when they designed the Van Wall car. And the Alpha 158 was in a private collection. And I'm not actually sure what the bloke who owns it does for a living. I think he might be a musician or something, judging by his haircut. The McLarens belonged to McLaren. The Leighton house had actually been bought in an auction years and years ago by a fan and had just been restored. And I think they actually did get an old Judd engine to go in it, and they have been running it. And the Ferrari 312 was another one that was for sale and probably is, on the other side of the world right now, hanging on someone's wall.
What's amazing, actually, about the Leighton house, I think we stood next to it. It may not be this exact one or one very similar to it, but I'm looking at the detail in this book, the detail on the rear wings and the sculpting of the aero. We stood next to that car for a good 20, 30 minutes, and I'm seeing things in this book that we never saw when we stood right next to it. It's fantastic that the level and depth of colour and the vibrancy of all the pictures. It's just immense what you can find in this.
it is really nice. James is, you know, he's not a happy snapper type photographer who just clicks away. He's very keen on getting everything right, and because he's got so much experience in doing these things, he knows exactly where to stick his lights, he knows exactly where to stick his little bits of white card that reflect the light back up at the car to show off its curves that much better. And he knows which angles to take it from. And he was also really, really picky about what studios he would use, because there are only a few studios in the country that have a coving that actually enables you to take a picture from above and get it totally right. There's lots and lots of studios that offer themselves as car photographic studios, but very, very few actually have that facility where you can take a top-down picture directly from above with a camera with the right lens on it so that you don't get any kind of distortion, because a lot of these places the ceiling is quite low, so you end up putting a wide angle lens on, so you have a car shaped like a rugby ball in the finished picture.
I didn't realise it was so difficult to do. It seems so natural as well.
You know, I always used to laugh at how much we used to have to pay photographers for their little bits and bobs and their cleft sticks and their digital capture and all the little things that used to go on at the tail end of their invoices, the Frappuccino and the cinnamon whirl. But actually, you know, they are pretty good at what they do, and they do largely a better job than we writers would manage.
But you're not just a writer either. I mean, when was it 2008 when you were following the Formula One circus, you kept your Flickr site up to date and you were out in the field with known photographers, named photographers. I think you were doing a piece for F1 Racing at the time, and you took some pretty handy snaps yourself.
Yeah, I went and did quite a few sessions, and it's really, really good to actually get out of the press room and see the cars going past, because the photographers really do see a lot, you know. Very often during a Grand Prix weekend, if you want to know who's driving well and who isn't driving well, you ask a photographer, because they're carrying these enormous 600 lenses. Even Canon have got an 800mm lens now, which is it's like a Jodrell Bank telescope or something. if you're pointing one of those at a Formula One car and the driver is totally offline and, you know, is getting their braking totally wrong, then you see it, because you're trying to, you know, you've got this thing that weighs between 15 kilos or something, balanced on a monopod, and trying to swing it round following the progress of this car. You know someone's driving badly. So from that point of view, it was a very educational experience, just watching each car come past and trying to spot who was doing what line. It really helps you train your eye. And also, some types of photography really aren't that difficult, provided you know where to stand. But of course, knowing where to stand is the trick. And following these guys around, you sort of see who work hardest to work out where the light is best and that sort of thing. Because photographers, some of the photographers are a little bit like some of the journalists. You kind of see Darren Heath and Lorenzo Belanca wandering off in one direction, and then another group of people a couple of corners behind following them. And when they move on, you get this little scuttling group of people like in a cartoon following and going to stand where they were standing to try and get the same shots.
How do you think Formula One photography is changing with the advent of media like the internet? Because obviously you're at the forefront of how things are changing in terms of journalism, because you have your blog and you're working on things like the Red Bulletin, which is obviously an e-magazine. But in terms of photography, is it changing in the same way, or is it not doing that yet?
I think the whole way it works has changed a massive amount in 10 years. It's basically the digital thing means that it's you can transmit far, far quicker than you used to be able to, and at a much higher quality. But also with that comes the expectation of the audience. So while it used to be perfectly permissible for there to be no photographs on the internet immediately after a race because everyone was on their 14.4 modems and couldn't see the pictures anyway, even if they waited an hour and a half to download them. The picture quality wasn't really up to it. Usually the colours were poor in early digital. So you'd have a big photo agency like LAT that would have some of the early, very annoyingly expensive digital cameras, just for the beginnings of the internet, and also for the papers that wanted it for their first editions. But most of it, 10 years ago, was still done on film. And as you can imagine, you've got these rolls and rolls and rolls of film. What do you do with them? The answer to that is that some poor mug had to go home early and take the rolls of film so that, you know, they could go down to the Boots 1 hour centre or whatever and be ready to go to the magazines and newspapers on the Sunday night. And so, to give you an example, the 2002 Austrian Grand Prix, which, you know, goes down in infamy as the one where Rubens Barrichello was ordered to slow down and let Michael Schumacher pass. I was already sitting in the departure lounge of Graz Airport waiting for my Ryanair flight with a big bag of film in my bag because I'd drawn the short straw that weekend and I'd go home early and miss the race and take the LAT film to Boots.
Actually to Boots?
No, I'm lying. It was some place called Metro or something. And of course, the other thing that brought in was what if they got nicked or lost or that sort of thing? It used to be Monza was a terrible place for theft. And there was a photographer once who worked for one of the other agencies who got their entire stock of film nicked because he put his bag down and wandered around the other side of the car and started looking for his papers or something. Meanwhile, someone came along, nicked his bag and made off with all the film.
And you wouldn't, obviously, you wouldn't get that now because it's digital and it all gets sent up and
you can have backups everywhere.
It's there when it happens.
Totally. And you find the big agencies all have a digital technician with them who is stationed permanently in the little photographer's area on the circuit. And the photographers come back with their memory sticks, give it to him or her, and he goes through it, makes a few basic corrections or edits and that sort of thing, and then transmits it straight away. So immediately after each session, you have pictures.
We have mentioned, actually, that we're big fans of the fact that Autosport is now available as a digital download. Has that changed? Have you tried that out? Are you still going to the news agency and buying Autosport? Did it change how you're going to read it and how you consume media?
Well, this is where I get a bit of an advantage because I work most of my days still at the Haymarket offices. I get Autosport on a Wednesday when it comes in. So I get to read Marcus Pye's tremendously raughty column every week before it arrives on newsagent shelves. But obviously now, you know, I could download it if I wasn't working there. And I think that's really good because people are increasingly dissatisfied with waiting for something to pop through their letterbox. I quite like that anticipation, except when I'm waiting for a check, in which case, you know, soon is never soon enough, is it, when you're waiting for a check. When the magazine comes through the door, it's actually quite nice. You know, I get my New Statesman on a Friday, get my auto car appears on a Wednesday, and it's quite nice. You know, it reaffirms that nature's rhythms are in action, aren't they? You know, everything's as it should be. But of course, if you want to read about something, you've got a burning desire to read about something in particular, then you always want it yesterday, don't you? So I think it's really good that they've decided to make it available. I think, you know, it is a big step for them because, like any publisher that is, you know, still rooted in the tradition of print media, it's very difficult to stick your stuff up online because someone is going to nick it. You know, it's always going to end up on some rapid share site or something. And some people are still very uncomfortable with that idea because at the end of the day, you're whole income stream comes from circulation and getting people to pay for it and getting people to pay to advertise in it. And when people are nicking it for free, it really does attack that revenue stream. And it makes it that much more difficult to keep up the quality of the publication because the thing with motor racing is it's a really expensive sport to cover. You know, probably this year, Formula One's going to be absurdly expensive. I think I'm probably banging the Sayward drum now, aren't I? This is something he's got to be in his bonnet about, the cost. And rightly so, you know, it's a good 25 grand, maybe 30 this year because China's on its own and Japan's on its own and you've got Korea. They're all really expensive places to go to. So to send a correspondent there, you know, if you've got people nicking your stuff for free, it makes it that much more difficult to actually send people to places to report from the ground.
Talking of that, actually, you're also working. You're working on an awful lot. You're working on a lot of things by the look of it. But something else.
Yeah, spinning. That's what it's all about.
Something else you're doing at the moment. Formula Santander. You are their official paddock spy.
Yes. I'm not sure where that name came from. It was certainly not on one of the early builds of the site. And then I thought, oh, I'm the paddock spy now. I must buy a very large magnifying glass. Why is it that people always think that spies carry large magnifying glasses? I mean, it's not in any Jean Le Carré novel I've ever read. Big magnifying glass. Maybe I should have one of those tiny little cameras that's disguised to look like something else.
Do you have plans to go into the paddock this year?
Being a paddock spy, you might need to be there.
Yes, we could sort of accuse you of transgressing the Trades Description Act at the moment.
I do have my spies. It may change because at the moment it's been the PR word is? Oh, yeah, a soft launch. That's it. Basically, the PR company that represents Santander in the UK got the contract to do this, and it all came together quite late in the day. So they actually started doing it just a few weeks before Bahrain. Tom Clarkson and I sat down and bashed out. We finally crafted about 9,000 words of content between us. To stock it, and it was going to launch before Bahrain, and then there were some delays in approval, and they wanted to change it, and there were some refinements put in. So finally, it went up there just before Australia. The next stage in the process is that Ferrari and McLaren are going to look at it and decide whether they like it, and hopefully one of their comics won't be get rid of that idiot paddock spy. And then it'll be kind of given an all-singing, all-dancing launch. Not next week, maybe the week after. I'm not sure yet. But in answer to the original question, yes, because this obviously is a position that pays. So it would be worth going to some races. The question now, of course, is accreditation. So another party that has to look at the site will be the FIA. And if it matches their quality criteria, accreditation will follow, and I will curse the paddock with my presence again. I have to say the FIA were very lenient last year. I went to the Italian Grand Prix, and they let me accredit myself as an agency, even though as an agency you technically have to supply 5 different publications that all meet the quality criteria. So they said, we've made an exception for you this once, but we won't be able to do it again because otherwise it's unfair on everyone else. So it was quite nice of them to, I won't say they bent the rules, I think they allowed some flexibility by a few degrees within the permitted box area of the rear wing. So I went in and did a bit of reporting for various people, did some research for the book. This year, I may go back to Monza again. There are a few races that could fit in the schedule, which I will go to and do some reporting from. Because, as Joe will say, there's nothing like actually being there because it enables you to see when people are lying to you because they look at you while they're lying to you. And it's just very useful for actually passing on properly what's going on rather than just repeating flim-flam because, we've all ranted about GNM in the past. Half of the stuff out there at the moment that passes for F1 News is just made-up misinformation that people just copy and repeat, and you repeat the lie often enough and it pretty much becomes the truth.
Do you enjoy going to the races? I mean, would you go to them all if you could?
I think I would, but I think my wife and the cats would have something to say about it. I really, really did enjoy my time as a sort of a semi full-time Grand Prix correspondent. Even when I was going to lots of races, I was only doing about half of them. When you do them all, it is quite grueling. If you look at the tail end of this year, when you get back from Brazil, you're straight out to Abu Dhabi again. So that's the reason why a lot of the people who work in F1 and go to all the races are single or have very understanding partners. But no, I loved it. The travel, with age comes a certain degree of acceptance of the conditions of economy travel. And actually, traveling in economy can be quite fun. It would be nice if we flew in business, but unless you work for the Virgin marketing team or the BBC or ITV, then you don't. You just sort of sit down the back. But, you know, you evolve coping strategies. There's lots of red wine flowing, mostly, or whatever. You take your iPod, because, you know, modern technology has really made economy travel fabulous, because, you know, you've got neck pillow, earplugs, iPod, feedback video, the constant little procession of minis. You know, what's to dislike about it? And then eventually, you know, you wind up at your destination and you're on the other side of the world. You know, what's not to like? It's an amazing privilege. I understand why some people get a bit cynical and jaded about it sometimes, but I never did. But I think my most inconvenient journey was to Japan the year before, where the Chinese embassy changed the visa regulations right at the last minute. So it ended up that I had to get on my motorbike at 5 a.m. and ride into central London so that I could be head of the queue when the passport office opened at 9 o'clock to pick up my passport. And I then had to ride down to the Haymarket offices, have a shower, get a taxi to Heathrow, where my wife met me with my luggage, and because she can't drive, she had taken bus and train. So finally I was reunited with my luggage just to get on the plane to Japan and then to China.
It's before you'd even left the country.
Is it any wonder she'd like you to stay at home?
It really was planes, trains and automobiles. So yeah, it can be a bit of a pain in the neck sometimes, but, you know, it beats cleaning toilets or things like that. You know, there's lots of people do crappy jobs that they hate. Lots of people who have very well-paid jobs hate their jobs. You know, accountants, management consultants, lots and lots of people who do those sorts of jobs that are really well-paid would take a good 50% cut and hack off a limb to pratt around, jetting off around the world to write about motor racing, because it's not rocket science, is it?
That leads us nicely on to racing this season. We've all got opinions on how well it's going so far. What do you think of racing in 2010?
Oh, this is a tricky one, isn't it? The racing in 2010. Well, speaking as I am before the Malaysian Grand Prix, which is, I was going to say it's bound to rain, but because I've said it's bound to rain, it now will be dry as, won't it? Well, it's fair to say that the Bahrain Grand Prix wasn't very interesting. Then again, you know, pick a Bahrain Grand Prix that has been interesting. They do their best to start off the season and make nice and make a big show of it. But really, the circuit just doesn't lend itself to Formula One and overtaking, and that extra little bit that they added after Turn 4 didn't really produce the overtaking opportunities they want. I think we haven't seen any big soap opera yet, which is what really we thrive on. We've been privileged the last few years, certainly from 2006 onwards, I think, that we've always had some sort of off-track soap opera to go along with whatever's been happening on track. So even if you've had a sort of a fairly dullish race, there's always been something to speak about, whether it's Michael Schumacher deliberately crashing his car at Raskas, whether it's about the whole spying thing in 2007, and then, of course, the whole thing with Lewis and the stewards and that sort of thing in 2008 and 2009. So that's the sort of stuff that keeps the internet going between races. This year, God, it's been so slow on the news. I can't believe last week people are talking about where the mirrors are. You know, did you hear this? That is the bottom. We've touched bottom. If people are talking about where the mirrors are and that sort of thing, that, you know, the smell you can smell, it's not burning rubber. It's the brain cells of all those journalists. They're trying to think, well, what am I going to write and stick up on the internet now? Because there is nothing happening. That's why I love Joe's frankness when he just writes at the end of one of his blog entries, nothing, no news happening.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see. Move along. But in terms of the racing, well, you know, it just goes to show that there's still work to be done on the aero. And I like the way that they're talking about curve again, because I thought that was a massive missed opportunity and something that, well, it pretty much fell out because they didn't really spec it with enough oomph to make it worth having. To make curves worth fitting on a car, then it needs to have some sort of advantage that outweighs the weight penalty. And the amount of power they were allowed to deploy just wasn't enough to make it worth having. So quite apart from the expense of developing a system, I'd like to see a formula where people aren't talking about tyres all the time. And one of the blog entries I was going to write, but I haven't had time to write yet, is this whole thing about tyres. Because for as long as you have a tyre supplier with their name on the tyre, especially in a formula that has a single tyre supplier, they're only ever going to make the best tyres they can. Because Bridgestone aren't going in any way, shape or form to produce a tyre that isn't as good as it can possibly be. So we end up with this situation where they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. Tyre degradation is the most boring subject in the universe. You know, you could put your children to sleep with it. You just get any driver or engineer to talk about tyre degradation, and even a hardened non-sleeper would be sent instantly into the land of Nod. It's a total cure for insomnia, that subject. So I think what they need to do is have an FIA-branded tyre, which can be made by anyone. You know, it could be made by Bridgestone. And then the FIA becomes the tyre supplier, and they can have any tyre they want. They can have one that is pink or green or red, whatever fancy colour they want to make it. They can make it last 5 laps until it shreds, or they can make it hard as nails and no grip. And they can totally rebalance the formula. And then only the FIA ever gets flagged off. And, you know, what the hell? They're used to it because everyone always blames them for everything. And it gives them a bigger choice of tyre supplier. Whereas at the moment they're saying, well, who can do it? They were talking about Kumho, but they've just, they're off down the financial swanny and wouldn't have had the expertise anyway. Same with Hankook. You know, this is a... This sport is the peak of motorsport. Why would you want to put tyres on a Formula One car that you would sort of not put on a Fiat Uno? I may be doing Hankook a disservice, but you know, they're only ever sort of on those cars where there's a different tyre manufacturer on each corner. I hope they don't mix their cross plies with the radials, though. Yeah, you're pretty too young to remember that advert from the 1970s.
I don't remember that at all, but I do agree. I do agree with your concept of what to do.
It ends with a shonky old Austin on its roof and a man in a flat cap looking a little bit bemused at his whole cross ply radial mixture leading to this awful road anarchy.
Well, that would spice up racing.
What, men in flat caps shaking their heads? Wasn't that called Colin Chapman? They could all have a hat-throwing contest at the end of the race. You know, people talking about, you know, spicing up the show. Well, a hat-throwing contest might mightn't it?
Tony Fernandez has that hat, so therefore surely he's going to win every single race. That's maybe the way Lotus can win.
He may just. And the great thing about Tony Fernandez is he's so down to earth. But you know, even though I was not present at Bahrain, my contacts and spies in the airline industry reported that, and this just goes to show how absurd some marketing departments are. In the Etihad hopper flight from Bahrain to Abu Dhabi, the Virgin marketing personnel were in business, and Tony Fernandez and all the bigwigs from Lotus were in economy. And it just goes to show how absurd and totally out of kilter the priorities of some teams are. You know, you would think that Virgin would be spending money on, I don't know, someone who can actually design racing cars to build their car, a fuel tank that actually holds enough fuel, a fuel tank that the actual suction device can suck up all the fuel in, you know, basic stuff. You know, I think Colin Chapman could have designed a fuel tank that could scavenge 50 years ago. I'm not sure why Nick Wirth with his, maybe his CFD facility is just a load of Atari 520 STs glued together in some sort of stack.
He's too busy playing Pac-Man.
Yeah, exactly. Or Minesweeper. Oh, that's a great story, actually. I've got a great Minesweeper story for you. Do you remember Jan Magnussen?
Yep. Driving sports cars now, right?
He is indeed. There's a fabulous story about Jan Magnussen when he was sort of struggling at Stewart and not being as quick as Rubens Barrichello. The engineers sat him down with a laptop showing him Rubens' telemetry and, you know, the little spike saying, this is where Rubens goes into a corner faster than you. This is where he brakes later than you. This is where he gets on the power earlier than you. Can you, you know, look and learn? And they all they go and leave him in the company of this laptop to look and learn. And they hear, you know, sounds of mouse clicking, and they think, well, you know, he's paying attention. He's having a good look. And then they go back 20 minutes later, he's playing Minesweeper.
Well, it's quite an addictive game.
we should probably, you know, have a big allegedly at the end of this.
I like it. I do like it.
Someone told me it may not be true, but it's too good not to repeat.
Never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Well, exactly. You know, if we didn't have, you know, half truths to hunt around, then half the magazines wouldn't get written. There'd certainly be far fewer web pages up there.
I think actually, does that cover all our questions?
I think that must be it. We've got the blog at stuartcodling.com.
Definitely worth checking out.
You're writing at formulasantander.com. Your photos are at flickr.com/photos/SC_pix, P-I-X. We know you've got an excellent book, Art of the Formula One Race Car. The only other thing I think you might want to plug is some kind of bike marathon charity event thing.
Yes. The next weekend, I'm going to be, and I have to enunciate this carefully, I'm going to be in the Muck Off 8, which is a 8-hour mountain bike enduro, which I'm doing with Anthony Rowlandson, who's the former Grand Prix editor of Autosport and now the executive editor of the Red Bulletin. And we're going to be doing this ridiculous thing, which has an 8-mile lap, and it's sponsored by this stuff called Muck Off, which you'll notice I'm saying very carefully, which is this weird pink goo that you spray on your bike and then hose down with water, and magically the muck is off. Sadly for me at the moment, it doesn't fix punctures, which is going to be my next job today.
And you're looking, how do we sponsor you for this?
There is a sponsorship page, and it's www.everydayhero.co.uk/something-else. I'll probably put a plug up for it on the blog at some point, and I'm going to be trying to get some sponsorship over the next week, not for us personally, but it's for a charity, a leukemia charity. So it's all in a good cause, and hopefully we'll heal the sick. And I'll certainly feel sick after 8 hours of riding a mountain bike up and down hills. And hopefully there'll be some nice food at the end of the day.
Stuart, you are a legend. You have given more to Side Podcast than we can ever really credit you for.
We didn't even do any training, which is amazing. And fortunately, the cat's not here to scare. But it's such a shame that David doesn't actually sound anything like me doing an impression of Alan Henry doing an impression of him, because it would just be the icing on the cake. But the training is a marvellous thing, and to actually get him to now do it, even though he does it very half-heartedly, he's like, I don't really talk like this. It's a beautiful thing. And when he's doing it in the press room, instead of throwing crunched up balls of paper at people, which is what he usually does, it's actually kept putting back in his box a little bit. He behaves a little bit better now for, you know, the odd thing sent down the line at him.
How awesome is that? That's fantastic. Just one last question actually for me, because I'm just really, really curious. I think the you first commented on Side Podcast summer of 2008, I think it was. What made you reach out and leave a comment on a blog, whereas in the past, I think you must have been one of the first Formula One journalists to reach out to
I think I was being mean about F1 racing.
Well, that sounds likely.
Yeah.
We're mean about lots of people. But what was it that really sort of made you first make that move and start commenting on people's blogs who are, you know, have no reason to expect comments from yourself?
Well, I think it was our publishing executive, which is a job title that's usually given to a bone-idle git who does nothing all day. And needless to say, since the recession, there are far fewer publishing executives doing the rounds because they also felt the sharp edge of the scythe. These people, obviously some of their responsibilities have been subsumed by people further up the food chain because people further up the food chain do it. They're addicted to Google alerts, which is something I knew nothing about until this person told me that you just sort of type the name of whatever you work for into Google alerts or something, and then every time someone writes about it, Google shops them to you, which it just seems like the internet Gestapo. But anyway, so here there's this website talking about the magazine and the changes. So I thought, well, you know, what the hell? Go and say hello. Because, you know, the readers of a magazine, as Hans always says, are the people who pay your mortgage at the end of the day. So the internet enables you to speak to them as never before, rather than, you know, you sitting in an office and then sitting at home and occasionally ringing up. But I'm afraid, it has to be said, the sort of people who write to magazines or ring them up are uniformly insane. The dread phrase that goes through the earpiece, you know, you pick up the phone, you don't know who it is, but you know it's an external call by the ringtone, you say hello, and the voice comes in, oh, hello, I wonder if you could help me, and you think, oh. And the great thing about the internet is that a lot of those people have gone away because there are usually people who were using you as a sort of glorified directory inquiries service. You know, do you have a telephone number from McLaren? And now they can go to McLaren.com and bother them directly. Most normal people who are well-adjusted and don't ring up and ask weird stuff quite happily chat away on sites like yours and the other ones that are dotted around and talk about all sorts of stuff not related to F1, you know, pandas, space travel, Doctor Who, all the things that, you know, we all talk about in the office. So it's like a giant open page that we can all scribble nonsense on, which, you know, certainly appeals to me and appeals to me straight away.
Like I said, you've really made, you've contributed so much to SciPodcast. It'd be nice if we could give something back to you.
I like to think that we nagged Stuart enough to start his blog.
Well, that's true. We did pester
him
into
blogging. Gave him the push to do it.
Without you, it would still be an error 404, I think, because there's no way I could have wrestled that thing up there. It was an enormous technology. It gives and it takes away, doesn't it? And trying to get this site up onto this server, wherever it is, it's hidden under Atlanta somewhere. It was ridiculously hard. And without your very kind help and technical support, it would still be one big PHP error in the sky and a load of, I won't say bashed out, a lot of carefully crafted copy still sitting on a laptop somewhere.
Are you enjoying blogging, though?
Yes, I wish I had more time to do it, but the problem with being a freelancer is that you never say no to anyone, so it just has to kind of come right at the end of that conga line of people who are all nagging you to get stuff done. And there have been so many times over the past month and a half especially that I've thought of a good idea for a blog but just been too busy to write it, and then the news agenda's kind of moved on. So I've got one half written somewhere that hopefully I'll finish this weekend and stick up before people get bored with the subject. I'll get around to writing the tire thing at some point, but I'm afraid that what have I got to do next week? I've got to write this sample chapter of the book, got to do captions, got to do a thing for McLaren, which if I told you, they would come and take my toes off because I signed a thing saying they could. all sorts of stuff, that all sorts of people that need to be kept happy before the blog gets full. So, you know, occasionally I see people on other blogs commenting and saying which blogs they like, and they say, I like Stuart Godwin's blog, but he doesn't put enough stuff on that. And I say, well, perhaps you can come and work for me as my secretary in the same way that Jackie Stewart has some poor embarrassed man in a silly pair of trousers following him round doing everything for him. And then I'd have more time for blogging.
Is tartan optional?
it, it would be for me. I don't think I have any tartan. It's a shame that for Jackie's secretaries, it's not an option, because certainly, especially the fellow with ginger hair, always looked a bit flushed. I don't know if it was his permanent complexion, but he always looked a bit embarrassed to be there in the trousers.
Well, you're super busy, but you still found time to talk to us, and we're very grateful.
Yes, we should.
I love speaking to you, and I've also not had as much time to hang out in the comments recently and, dump my special blend of nonsense in there, just because it's all been super busy. But, it means that the cats don't have to get sent out to find their own dinner, and everyone lives at the end of the day.
Stuart, if there's anything we can do to repay you for everything you've given to us, we will. And we will encourage anybody listening to the show to now rush out and buy The Art of the Formula One Race Car. Because if you have a soul, you have to have this book. It's the kind of book that makes you want a bigger coffee table. And I've never had a book like that before. I'm cradling it in my arms now. I'm already in love with it. It's the best £30 I've spent this year, and I encourage everybody to go out and buy it, and with any luck to encourage the publishers to spec a second edition.
And of course, if you've got a wobbly desk or a wobbly chair or a table, then it's marvellous for propping it up, and then you can buy another one to read while the other one's propping your table up.
It is quite a sturdy book. It would work for that.
Yeah, the heaviest desk will not make an imprint on this tone.
Stuart, you're ace. We love you to pieces. Do come back and talk to us. Please do. Don't be a stranger. We're always free.
Anytime.
Whenever you're slightly less busy, and we're always happy to plug your stuff, and we'll make sure we give you a big plug. And I think Christy needs a copy too, so I might go out and get another copy.
And, right, why not email the PR company and ask for a review copy? Because, they might have a big pile of them that they're desperate to give away before the next load of books arrive. And, they might just do that, because they're all friendly towards blogs and things nowadays. Everyone is. Everyone wants to cuddle.
And that is the title of the show.
Everyone wants to cuddle. I will get Skype next time. I'll join the 21st century. I'll get Skype. But the only thing that worries me about Skyping you is that when you speak to Joe, he sounds like that Cher tune from a few years ago. And that sort of thing. He doesn't really talk like that, does he? And so when I went to Monza, I actually sat near him and watched his larynx go like that as he spoke, just to make sure that he wasn't suffering some larynx malfunction. It is just the Skype that makes you sound like Cher.
Luckily, you don't sound like that, because the wonders of the ye old telephone system actually work better with Skype. So you don't need to join the Skype century, 21st century with Skype, because we called Joe on the telephone last week and it sounded better. So I think you should stick with the telephone. It sounds great, and you don't sound like you've been talking through a vocoder all day.
Because who needs pitch correction? The girls allowed, but for us, no.
Oh man, we could just talk all day. I love it. We've got to let you go. You have to go eat, and we have to draw this show to a close, because it's just going to be the longest podcast ever, even if it is the best podcast ever. Stuart, you're a legend.
Thank you.